This is 40ANM in 5, a download of 40ANM LLC, recorded at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday, April 12th. I'm Chris Bohm, and welcome back to this, a weekly selection of highlights from the past week. 1 year ago this week, we began regular weekly downloads of 40ANM in 5. In each download on tech sector and related global news and policy issues, we've tried to cover at least one story on financial services, another on the environment, immigration, or whatever might be a hot topic of the week, and still other stories on innovations, new services, and sometimes a quirky story about where technology and life cross paths. This week, we're bringing you something a little different, a retrospective snapshot of the past year. Coming up are 10 short segments on just a few of the many topics that have in some small and in some big ways shaped the past year. So if you'll excuse us for a slight change in audio quality as we move from segment to segment, as we change mics in mid-year, we'll talk about virtual currency, the year that was in surveillance revelations, data protection regulations, patent and IT procurement reform, the Federal Reserve, and big data. But first off this week, we have a story from only a few weeks ago, one that we discussed on March 10th. It's a story about Bitcoin, problems with some of its largest exchanges, and global discussions regarding how or if virtual currencies should be regulated. Only 2 weeks later, the IRS in the U.S. would decide that Bitcoin should be treated like any other equity, and for tax purposes, be subject to capital gains taxes. For now, that calms the debate in the U.S., but as we discussed here on March 10th, not for everyone. For the past several weeks, we've reported on the continuing saga of Bitcoin and its exchanges. In the past 10 days, on February 28th, one of these exchanges, once the largest, Mt. Gox, filed for bankruptcy in Japan. In addition to the roughly 750,000 customer bitcoins that the company believes to have lost, it discovered that it may have lost as much as 100,000 of its own, amounting to a total of nearly $500 million in losses. Mt. Gox is looking into the possibility of criminal proceedings should further investigations find that the losses were due, as most are assuming, to underlying criminal activity that exploited the security failings of Mt. Gox's exchange mechanism. Bitcoin may ultimately attempt to continue as a going business in an effort to attempt to recover customer losses. But the announced bankruptcy plans in Japan come as another exchange, Flexcoin, announced plans to shutter, if only temporarily, due to customer Bitcoin losses. Several news outlets in the past week, including the New York Times, Newsweek, and its sister publication, The Washington Post, have commented on just how bizarre the Bitcoin and Mt. Gox stories have become in the past 2 weeks. Newsweek announced this past week that they believed that they'd found the Japanese creator of Bitcoin, Satoshi Nakamoto, living in L.A. under the alias Dorian Nakamoto. According to the Associated Press, which claimed to have scored an exclusive with Bitcoin's secretive founder, Mr. Nakamoto claimed that he would tell all if taken to lunch. But after having sushi at the Associated Press's L.A. office, Mr. Nakamoto claimed that he never heard of Bitcoin until Newsweek came calling. Newsweek continues to stand by its story that it had found the founder. Meanwhile, last week Japan announced that Bitcoin will be treated as a commodity under its laws and not as a currency, and would not be subject to banking rules as a result. But Japan did take the step to ban banks and trading houses from trading in Bitcoin, just as China did in December. Now, for those of us who grew up in the 70s reading the Guinness Book of World Records, you might recall the Yap Island coins known as Rai, which were, as their inclusion in Guinness might suggest, the world's largest physical currency, with some of the stone coins at over 8 feet in diameter. At the time, Guinness helpfully pointed out that the largest Rai could be used to purchase a wife or a canoe. Yap Island Rai, like Bitcoin, cannot presently be found traded by the currency desks of the London Financial Futures Exchange. But of course, that is where the similarity ends. But there remains the fact that despite what Japan's cabinet may be calling Bitcoin, its global users and defenders both call it a currency and use it as such. In a November hearing focusing on the issue of Bitcoin, in particular the Silk Road and its alleged ties to drug dealing, and the Silk Road has since been shut down, the Senate Banking Committee described virtual currencies as legitimate financial services. As Craig Timberg of The Post pointed out on March 8th, since its initial issuance in 2009, Bitcoin has gradually gained acceptance as a digital currency that, unlike dollars or euros, can move about the globe with low fees and no regulation. And despite the shuttered exchanges and cries of criminal money laundering activity, the bitcoins are still trading higher by 10% than a week ago, with each worth approximately $600. The massive amounts in which bitcoins are presently traded, and how or if their value is or isn't regulated, reminds me to a certain extent of discussions at the Fed and in Congress in the 90s regarding how to reflect the value of growing e-commerce transactions in the then critical monetary policy tracking tools known as M1 and M2. In the November hearing, Senate Banking Chair Tom Carper commented, "Virtual currencies, perhaps most notably Bitcoin, have captured the imagination of some, struck fear among others, and confused the heck out of the rest of us." At the time, there was talk that then-Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke had the intention of including virtual currencies under the umbrella of U.S. currency regulation. The European Banking Authority, or EBA, is set to create a task force in July to advise on whether virtual currencies should be regulated. As a commodity, Japan noted last week that Bitcoin could be taxed in that country. Now, as Gail Sullivan pointed out in the Washington Post on March 7th, financial journalists are in no way unanimous as to what all of this regulatory discussion means, with the New York Times finding Japan's ruling tantamount to a hands-off approach to virtual currency, and the Financial Times noting that, as a result, Japan has taken a far harsher stance via taxation on Bitcoin than any other authority globally to date. Now this despite the fact, as Wall Street Journal pointed out, that few people in Japan actually own Bitcoins, despite that they were invented there. A tempest in a coin pot, perhaps. But by the way, if you're interested, the App Islanders still do use Rye, though usually only for ceremonial exchanges. The currency of preference today among the App Island, which is a part of the Federated States of Micronesia, is in fact the U.S. dollar. When the surveillance revelations began in the press on June 5th, it's safe to say that few imagined just how much these issues would come to dominate the news. But the first hearing in Washington to really comprehensively discuss not only the news, but also potential implications for law and policy, was a marathon public session of the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board held on July 8th. Here is a summary that we did of that session in the July 15th edition. The U.S. Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board held its first public meeting this past Tuesday, July 9th, in Washington, D.C., a seven-hour session chaired by David Medine, a former partner in the WilmerHale law firm and Federal Trade Commission attorney now confirmed as chair of the PCLOB. According to Mr. Medine, the focus of the meeting was very precise, to determine what improvements should occur to surveillance programs that presently operate under U.S. law pursuant to Section 215 of the U.S. Patriot Act and Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Altering how the FISA court operates is one of several suggestions that deserve serious consideration, said David Medine in an interview reported after the hearing by Bloomberg. In order to connect the dots, we need the broadest segment of metadata, said Stephen Bradbury, the former head of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel under President Bush, speaking of the data retained for purposes of the NSA's PRISM program. But Jamil Jaffer, lawyer for the American Civil Liberties Union, called the NSA programs a massive dragnet that is both unwise and unconstitutional. He also accused the Bush and Obama administrations of having misled the public about the scope of surveillance under anti-terrorist programs. The USA Patriot Act authorized the FBI and NSA to gather records that are relevant to an authorized investigation, which, according to Mr. Jaffer, was supposed to be a limit on what was gathered. Instead, he said, the government has taken a view that it should have all phone records because someday some of it may prove useful to investigation. It can't be the case that everyone's phone records are relevant to investigations, which makes the bulk collection of telephone records illegal, added an attorney for the Center for Democracy and Technology. Kate Martin, director of the Center for National Security Studies, warned the panel of the rise of a system of secret law being made by the FISA court, a court which operates behind closed doors. Retired federal judge James Robertson, a former member of the FISA court, said that he came away from his experience deeply impressed with the judges and their commitment to protecting Americans from unreasonable searches. But he said the panel is one-sided, and that is not a good thing. A judge needs to hear both sides of any case, and at present, he said, there is no one in the process to object. He urged the panel to recommend a change that would allow someone or some group to argue against expanded surveillance requests. Otherwise, the judges effectively operate not as judges, but merely as agency managers. Robertson served on the court from 2002 to 2005, but told the Associated Press that he left the court over concerns about surveillance. James Baker, who served in the Justice Department and represented the government before the FISA court from 1998 to 2007, said having an adversarial check in place could slow down much-needed surveillance approvals. Public participation in the session, however, included no representatives from industry, an absence which was notable given that much of the discussion centered around what role those firms should play in surveillance programs, according to the International Association of Privacy Professionals. There was some discussion as to whether private industry should be made to keep important data, say, for 5 years under a new data retention requirement. Although Sharon Bradford Franklin, senior counsel at the Constitution Project, commented that a data retention law would not only open up possibilities for the use of data by government, but also could increase the likelihood of its possible misuse by private industry. Two other recommendations included requiring the FISA court to declassify portions of its work and establishing tougher legal standards for the government to meet before it allowed to collect information involving the communication of U.S. citizens. "We had a range of recommendations on all sides that have given us a lot of things to think about," David Medin said after the meeting. Mr. Medin also acknowledged the lack of private industry participation in the meeting, but said that the PCLOB is very much interested in their input and welcomed not only industry input, but also public comment in this area until August 1st, the comment deadline. "We are going to continue to review the FISA court opinions, and we're going to continue to get briefed from the government so that we can better understand the details of these programs," as reported by Bloomberg. Mr. Medin said that the panel intends to release a report with recommendations on the NSA programs. The other members of the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board include retired Judge Patricia Wald, former Bush administration attorney Rachel Brand, who is now a lawyer for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, James X. Dempsey, vice president of the Center for Democracy and Technology, and Elizabeth Collins Cook, former assistant attorney general at the Justice Department. In the midst of the surveillance revelations, some international policy discussions took on very different tones, and in some cases, changed in non-too-subtle meaningful ways. For no other topic could this be more true than for European Union data protection revisions and EU-US discussions on privacy issues. On November 4th of last year, we did a wrap-up of a public panel discussion in Washington involving U.S. Federal Trade Commissioner Julie Brill and member of the European Parliament, Jan-Philipp Albrecht of Germany. Few discussions that fall more helpfully outlined the various EU-US issues and positions. On Tuesday, October 29th, U.S. Federal Trade Commissioner Julie Brill and member of the European Parliament Jan-Philipp Albrecht, who is member of the German Greens Party and rapporteur for privacy and data protection in the Parliament's Libe Committee, addressed a packed auditorium of the Cosmos Club in Washington, D.C. for a 90-minute event sponsored by the European Institute. Commissioner Brill's remarks were perhaps the most vigorous defense heard to date of U.S. efforts to police compliance with the U.S.-EU Safe Harbor Data Protection Program. Negotiated in 2001-2002 as a means for U.S. companies to certify that they were in compliance with a set of principles from the EU's tough privacy rules, the safe harbor has come under most recent scrutiny given surveillance revelations. In terms that were once both passionate and lawyerly, Commissioner Brill stated that although the Snowden leaks may, in our best mutual interests, serve as a catalyst for long overdue change with regard to surveillance, the events also highlight the distinctions between national security and commercial uses of data, and the Federal Trade Commission's remit is, of course, the latter. In the course of prosecuting this remit, Commissioner Brill encouraged her European colleagues and consumer privacy organizations to raise concerns and any substantive leads to the FTC that should be enforced under Safe Harbor. To that end, she added, the FTC follows all leads, including those it develops on its own, bringing 10 cases since 2009, and prosecuting Google, Facebook, MySpace, among others, and required new compliance processes and audits for up to 20 years for some infractions. She also noted that a consent decree with Google had resulted in $22.5 million in civil penalties. Commissioner Brill also emphasized that for the Parliament to focus on ending or reopening the safe harbor would be folly, as Europe, like the U.S., does not blend compliance with privacy rules for national security and commercial interests, the target of safe harbor, under the same authority. When it comes to safe harbor, she added, we are the cop on the beat, and the actions we take under our authority build trust day in and day out. Jan-Philipp Albrecht, member of the European Parliament, emphasized that the Libe Committee's approval only a week earlier of a vast new regulatory reform of European data protection rules was a long overdue step forward toward a true single market for privacy in the European Union, which had been hobbled for over 15 years of disparate national rules implementing the prior EU directive. In the context of Europe's outrage over the surveillance revelations, Mr. Albrecht was careful to point out that Parliament's action shouldn't be seen as a lack of trust and respect for the FTC, but as a concern regarding the U.S. legal environment, which, in Mr. Albrecht's terms, has privacy completely subservient to issues of national security. He added that issues of balance, national security interests with fundamental rights to privacy, are our problem as well in the EU, but that our privacy laws, as he put it, begin from a different fundamental. But it was in answering a question regarding the EU's draft regulation that Mr. Albrecht seemed to get the most palpable response among the audience. Mr. Albrecht was asked about the draft's Article 43A, which by its words requires the permission of the relevant EU data protection authority before a transfer of European personal data could be made to a third country's law enforcement. How could this be complied with? Wouldn't the requirement essentially end the safe harbor arrangement? And how would European regulators deal with the costs and manpower of so many new requests, were just a few of the points raised. Mr. Albrecht responded that this language, in 43A, does nothing more than restate a requirement that was already there under the current Data Protection Directive, adding that if you look at this language today and are thinking that it, having the approval of the regulator for transfers, is something new, then it calls into question whether your actions to date, in any respect, have been legal. If your transfers were valid before, then they will be valid in the future, he added. But what this answer did, as well as the uncomfortable shifting in the seats that could be seen among the many U.S. attorneys in the room, was to underscore both a clever tactic by Parliament and seldom noted difference between European and U.S. legal environments. Whereas U.S. lawyers will most often see new words and rightly assume new requirements, the same cannot always be said in Europe. True, U.S. companies collecting and processing data from European citizens must do so under the imprimatur of filings and relationships with the European data protection authorities, or via the safe harbor. But to have that imprimatur stated in such succinct terms, embodying what might otherwise seem to be a case-by-case reporting requirement, arguably does have far greater meaning. Mr. Albrecht said that he recognized that how the U.S. and Europe deal with surveillance and access to data will also be crucial for shared goals that we have internationally. We don't, for instance, he said, have a majority at the ITU. And if we throw fundamental values such as this overboard, he added, it does damage to our shared goals in environments such as this. When asked if he felt that the finalization of the EU regulation might be extended beyond the expected close of May deadline before parliamentary elections, Mr. Albrecht was firm. We have been deliberating now for 3 years, he said, and the current concerns do not change for Europe what are fundamentals that pre-existed this debate. You also have to remember that the national security issues in Europe are ultimately under the competency of member states in the EU. To put off finalization in view of potentially addressing these issues, even in our own markets, would not do any good. May is a very good date, he said. If we need to build coalitions for further work and remake consensus, we will be thinking about 2017-18 at the earliest, and that is far too late. In the weeks and months after last fall's difficulties with the launch in the U.S. of the healthcare.gov website, a few key pieces of legislation suddenly took on new meaning. One of these was FITARA, the Federal Information Technology Acquisition and Reform Act. Poised to introduce the most sweeping changes to how the government purchases and manages huge IT products and services, FITARA passed the House in late 2013, and then would again on February 25, 2014. Presently, a similar bill has been introduced in the Senate. But here is a story originally reported on by National Public Radio and others about its sponsors and where the bill stood on November 25th. Congressman Daryl Issa, chairman of the House Government Oversight and Reform Committee and Republican of California, is co-author of a once-obscure House bill the Federal Information Technology Acquisition Reform Act, or FITARA, which now, thankfully to many, seems to have new legs. According to NPR, to address the management problem that now sits at the core of problems with federal IT procurement, FITARA would give the role of Chief Information Officer, or CIO, at the heart of federal agencies, with more budget authority power and prominence. FITARA's co-author is Congressman Jerry Connolly, Democrat of Virginia. He believes that greater accountability for a CIO will not only mean better written contracts, which will help make it harder for firms to potentially get away with bad work, but will also help to attract stronger candidates to these CIO jobs. Congressman Issa and Connolly could not be different, either in politics or temperament, and each often vocally disagrees with the other on nearly every other issue. But on this one, they're practically walking arm in arm. Connolly's Northern Virginia district is home to many IT contractors, and his constituents are among those who work on many of these deals. Besides strengthening CIOs, the bill would also clarify current law that allows for open-source software solutions, which Congressman Connolly also hopes will be more appealing to smaller companies as potential contractors, according to NPR. The next move on FITARA is up to the Senate, as the House passed it in June as an amendment to a defense bill. Patent trolling and numerous pieces of draft legislation aimed at eliminating the practice remained a hot topic throughout 2013. And only last week, it was reported that the latest legislative effort to stem the tide of patent trolling had stalled in the Senate. But here is discussion of the key issues and where we stood on potential legislation and executive action on June 3, 2013. On Wednesday, May 29th, Senator John Cornyn, Republican of Texas, introduced what is at least the fourth piece of significant draft federal legislation this term designed to crack down on abusive patent litigation in the U.S. As reported last week by the Hill newspaper in announcing the Cornyn legislation, many tech companies continue to complain in the U.S. of threats of lawsuits by firms that have no plans to create any products. These companies, often called patent trolls, purchase cheap patents, find companies using similar technologies, and then threaten to bring court action for infringement in order to force an expensive settlement rather than costly litigation. This and other pieces of draft legislation seek to stem the tide of such suits because of a growing concern that the costs of vexatious litigation direct resources away from research, development, wages, and growth. Many, including Senator Charles Schumer, Democrat of New York, who has also introduced draft legislation, the Patent Quality Improvement Act, have emphasized that such troll suits are a significant draw on innovation in the U.S., particularly forcing smaller companies to forego advancing new technologies and developments in order to prepare for potential litigation. In addition to this most recent proposal, the SHIELD Act, which is a bill co-sponsored by Congressman Peter DeFazio, Democrat of Oregon, and Jason Chaffetz, Republican of Utah, would require plaintiffs to pay for a defendant's attorney fees and other legal costs if their patent lawsuit fails in court. Both bills were the subject of significant discussion at a panel on the global intellectual property landscape on May 9th, held by the Hogan Lovells Law Firm in Washington, D.C., as part of its Winnick International Telecoms and Internet Forum. In particular, the concept of fee shifting to the loser in a patent infringement suit as a methodology to discourage patent troll cases was a significant focus of discussion, most recently at a panel of experts convened by the Congressional Internet Caucus in a debate forum hosted last week in Capitol Hill on patent litigation. The audio of this debate has been posted to the Congressional Internet Caucus site. While many are focusing on the debate over merits of each of these pieces of draft federal legislation, the state of Vermont quietly moved during the third week in May to enact the first-in-the-nation law to target patent trolling. Vermont's law, H-299, which will be codified at 9 VSA 4195 to 4199, is entitled The Bad Faith Assertions of Patent Infringements. The legislation enumerates a set of factors to help judges distinguish legitimate from illegitimate patent claims. Eric Goldman, writing on May 22nd as a contributor to Forbes magazine's Tech Online, believes Vermont's approach to be promising. However, the creation of multi-factor tests to determine the quality of intellectual property claims in high-tech areas does not often remain a helpful long-term approach. Mr. Goldman cited the 1999 Anti-Cyber Squatting Consumer Protection Act as one example. While the law effectively quashed cyber squatting practices in the near term, according to Forbes, domain name squatters quickly adapted their approaches in a way to avoid the law. Mr. Goldman finds the Vermont approach unique in that it creates a threats action, or a cause of action that the recipient of a patent suit can bring against the asserter for wrongfully asserting legal rights. Although these types of actions, which give the recipient of a potentially frivolous suit immediate counteraction, are uncommon in the U.S., they are common in the U.K. and other Commonwealth countries, according to Mr. Goldman. It remains to be seen whether Vermont ultimately has the legal authority to regulate patent activities, which have historically and constitutionally been the domain of federal law in the U.S. However, with significant and innovative legislation advancing both at the federal and state levels, there is little doubt that there will be a coming legislative crackdown on patent trolling in the U.S. The so-called Volcker Rule, proposed in the wake of the financial services meltdown of 2008, was to seek to curb potentially abusive trading practices by financial service firms trading on their own accounts. The finalization of the rule among the U.S. banking regulators came coincidentally not long after a decision had been reached by the Obama administration to advance Janet Yellen as candidate to replace Ben Bernanke as chair of the Federal Reserve, and Stanley Fischer to replace Ms. Yellen as vice chair. Here we talk about both topics on December 16th of 2013. Each week we have tried to bring you at least one story on the financial services industry and international markets, and this week we had a big one. After nearly 2 years of advocacy by lobbyists, academics, and interested others, an intense period even by Washington standards, the long-awaited Volcker Rule was approved this past Tuesday by five U.S. agencies, the Federal Reserve, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and the Securities and Exchange Commission. The rule, one of the most heavily debated outgrowths of the 2010 Dodd-Frank law, passed in the wake of the greatest economic crisis in the U.S. in generations, will largely prohibit banks from proprietary trading, which is essentially a ban on banks using their own funds for profit, if these funds are protected through federal deposit insurance or access to Federal Reserve loans. While industry lobbyists have long argued that proprietary trading did not contribute to the financial crisis, Wall Street saw the writing on the wall early, making large internal adjustments and closing proprietary trading shops shortly after passage of Dodd-Frank. In the 2 years since the Volcker Rule was proposed in draft and championed by former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker, industry lobbied changes to the proposal have met with precious few successes, with the primary focus of their efforts most recently on how exemptions will be applied to permit banks to trade in service to a client, referred to in the industry as market making, and how the bank can engage in hedging against risks. In the final rule, any hedging must be shown to demonstrably reduce or otherwise significantly mitigate one or more specific identifiable risks. And this backstop must be in tandem with correlation analysis and ongoing calibration to support and manage the hedging, respectively. Also, much like a critical element of Sarbanes-Oxley and its panoply of corporate reporting requirements implemented in 2005, the Volcker Rule will require executives to certify that processes are in place and reasonably designed to achieve compliance. The rule will take effect in July of 2014, with the Federal Reserve voting on Tuesday to give banks extra time until July 2015 to come into compliance. And in related news, Reuters confirmed late last week that it is likely that the U.S. Senate will vote this coming week on President Obama's choice of Janet Yellen to be the next chief of the Federal Reserve. Last month, the Senate Banking Committee approved her nomination with a 14-8 vote, and it's widely expected that she will be confirmed by the Senate to replace Ben Bernanke, who steps down as Fed Chair effective January 31, 2014. It was also revealed late last week that Stanley Fischer is likely to be appointed Vice Chairman of the Federal Reserve to replace Janet Yellen in that role. In the midst of an unprecedented series of developments that commenced last spring, with rumors that Larry Summers was to be chosen to succeed Mr. Bernanke, and then Mr. Summers pulling himself out of contention, there has always been a strong undercurrent of discussion and praise for Stanley Fischer's work and the feeling that he would be an undeniable asset to the Fed. Not only has Mr. Fischer received highest marks for his handling of the Israeli economy, where he served as head of its central bank, and as longtime professor at MIT, where he, among other things, supervised Ben Bernanke's thesis. But he also has served as number two at the IMF during a time of financial crises from Asia to Mexico. Just as Janet Yellen has been widely recognized as the strongest credentialed candidate to lead the Fed in the modern era, Mr. Fisher's expertise internationally will no doubt be a tremendous asset to Ms. Yellen. On July 15th of last year, we did a story that brought together numerous news items over the previous year on the issue of big data, and in particular, predictive search and advertising. Several key firms were and still are hard at work to help shape the scope of the killer app versus the potential creepy app. And in this July 15th segment, we talk a little bit about what these distinctions may mean. With the launch of Graph Search, several online journals in the past week have made available stories that they have done in recent past on the intersection of technology, law, and privacy preferences. One such story, by Forbes staff writer Kashmir Hill, reported on a New York Times piece from 2012 on targeted advertising done by none other than Target. It is well known that every time you go shopping, particularly with a store loyalty card, you share details about your purchasing patterns with retailers. Many of these retailers are studying those details to figure out what it is that you like, what you need, and for instance, which coupons are most likely to make you happy as a customer. As Forbes discussed, Target statistician Andrew Pohl had worked on a model for the store chain that assigns every customer a guest ID number tied to their credit card name or email address, which stores information on purchases they've made, along with demographic information that the store has collected or bought from other sources. In analyzing this data, some useful patterns emerge to the retailer. For instance, many shoppers purchase soap and cotton balls. But when someone suddenly starts buying lots of scent-free soap, coupled with extra big bags of cotton balls, in addition to hand sanitizers and washcloths, the statistics have shown the high likelihood that the customer may be getting close to a pregnancy delivery date. About 25 products were identified that, when taken together, allowed Mr. Pohl to assign each shopper a pregnancy prediction score. The score could also help in estimating a due date within a small window so that the store could send relevant customers coupons corresponding to different stages of pregnancy. As Forbes highlighted, perhaps it's a boy based upon the color of a rug purchased. The opportunities for potential analysis here could be myriad. There was one early unintended consequence, however, in that one irritated parent from Minneapolis, Minnesota, felt the need to complain to his local Target store that his teenage daughter was receiving pregnancy-related coupons from the chain. The manager of the store apologized, as reported by Forbes, and then followed up with an apology and a phone call some days later. On that call, the manager would learn that the targeted ads resulted in a discussion at home, which revealed that the daughter was in fact pregnant. Target had discovered fairly quickly that, when made so obvious that Target knew about their pregnancy, in the words of the Forbes reporter, it creeped people out. Further, if the customer might have simply been buying materials for someone else, the targeted advertising could be wrong about the individual receiving the ads altogether, with embarrassing or even worse consequences. Target's answer to the conundrum was rapid and sound. They began bundling the baby-related product advertisements in their materials with other completely unrelated ads, alongside lawnmowers, wine glasses, and the like. Thus, it still got the prospectively right ads to the potentially right customer, but also did not, in the words of the Forbes reporter, creep the customer out, or worse, put the customer off the chain due to what, at its core, might have been a decent idea for the customer's benefit. What Target learned and what other retailers are learning, if attentive to their brand reputation in the context of targeted advertising, is that even when something may be perfectly legal and statistically possible, is it the right thing to do? Or even if it may be the right thing to do, at its core, is there a right way and a wrong way to do it? If a customer does benefit from and want to receive ads targeted to something so potentially sensitive as a pregnancy, is it the kiss of death for the retailer for the customer to know so inelegantly obviously that they are being targeted? Perhaps yes. Some of the most interesting stories of the past year have also been some of the quirkiest. This includes this November 11, 2013 piece on violinist Hilary Hahn, who, just about to release her three-year project album entitled In 27 Pieces, the Hilary Hahn Encores, has often made the most of new and online media in attempts to connect not only with her fans, but also the broader listening public. Hilary Hahn, the 33-year-old virtuoso violinist from Virginia, has long been one of classical music's brightest stars. From child prodigy and debut with the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra at age 11, to first major record deal at age 16, she has released 14 albums and toured the globe. She once said that she had played some solo Bach every day since she was aged 8. But the past few years have also shown her to be one of a select few classical artists to embrace new media in a way that not only has proved to be savvy for marketing purposes, but has also endeared her to fans globally with her quirky personality and self-effacing manner, traits that in the music world are often just as uncommon. Ms. Hahn's musical prowess and a bit of social whirl were both on display earlier this week in Greenwich Village at the Greenwich House Music School, where she debuted her new album entitled In 27 Pieces, the Hilary Hahn Encores. The New York Times described the event as marathon concert, but also part school day and carnival, as in four sets spread across two sessions, all 27 brief pieces that she had commissioned from 27 composers were performed with her recital partner, Corey Smith. Ms. Hahn also arranged to have the scores of these brief pieces be published together in both physical and digital formats to coincide with the album's release. For those who have visited Hilary Hahn's YouTube channel or been a party to her many tweets, video blogs, and Facebook posts, the release of this project on which she's worked for nearly 2 years, the Encores Project, has been much anticipated, discussed, and loved over. Jennifer Higdon, Valentine Silvestroff, Mark Anthony Turnage, and David Del Tredici are just a few of the featured composers, each of whom had other works on display at the Greenwich event last week. Many of the videos and blog posts she and her team makes are more or less conventional, like, for instance, her interview with dancer Lil Buck, who performed on October 24th with her at the Annenberg Center Gala. Others, as the Tampa Bay Times performing arts critic John Fleming wrote in February, are delightfully loopy, like the very droll one-sided Q&A she conducted one night with a betta fish in her hotel's fish tank. Her Twitter feed is often occupied by notes from her violin case, a quirky set of tweets about her travels told from the perspective of, you guessed it, her violin case. And as she told the Tampa Bay Times, I have a laptop and my phone, that's it. And the internet makes it easy, although sometimes on the road I'll go weeks without a good connection from one hotel to the next, which makes it hard to post videos. In a recent interview with NPR, she characterized the In 27 Pieces project as a CD of desserts, like the cake after a good meal, which is frequently what an encore is. Hahn hopes that by commissioning and performing these shorter pieces from so many up-and-coming composers, she'll introduce many new names and works and perhaps create some new favorites with listeners. And finally, some stories on innovations and technology developments are truly awe-inspiring, making us simply sit back and take in the wow factor of the moment. Few stories like this can compare to the next, and our final story of this retrospective, on the little spaceship that could, Voyager 1's confirmed exit out of the solar system and into interstellar space from July 7th, 2013. And finally, launched way back in 1977, the U.S. space probe Voyager 1 has now traveled so far from home, nearly 18.5 billion kilometers from Earth, that the constant chatter of data that it puts out takes 17 hours to reach Earth and NASA computers in the U.S. According to NASA, as reported in a piece by the BBC, the spacecraft is likely poised on the edge of the sun's domain, ready to push out beyond the solar system, the first man-made craft to do so. The particles streaming away from the sun have by now been reduced to a trickle. In 2004, Voyager reached a turbulent region of the solar system known as the heliosheath. This was expected to be the final stage before its leap into interstellar space, but the milestone instead brought about a discovery. A distinct boundary region at the edge of the solar system, now called the heliosheath depletion region. Once the spacecraft is beyond the sun's magnetic influence, it will truly be in uncharted territory. But as reported by the BBC, like a surfer who rides the edge of a wave, Voyager will take some time to move completely out of the boundary zone. This edge may be turbulent, we just don't know, according to officials. Voyager 1 is on course to approach a star called AC793888, but it will only get within 2 light-years of it, and it will take roughly 40,000 years to make the trip.
The Voyager has sufficient power in its plutonium cells to keep working well into the next decade, according to NASA. But to date, nearly every milestone with the Voyager has been a surprise.
And that will be all for us this week. We hope that you've enjoyed this look back on the year that was, the first full year for 40AM5. But before we sign off, a few facts and figures about 40AM5. Each week, stories are written up throughout the week. Each episode is recorded using a Yeti digital mic. Theme music is composed on Finale music notation software and played by Garrett and Personal Orchestra. Each episode is produced using Final Cut Pro, and an entire episode is typically recorded, produced, and posted in roughly 2 hours on a weekend night. If you were to listen to all 40 episodes end-to-end over the past year, it would take you roughly 11 and a quarter hours. Thank you for listening, and for more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least two online or print news sources, or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from The Wall Street Journal, The Guardian, The Washington Post, The BBC, Forbes Online, National Public Radio, and Reuters. Thank you, as always, for listening and joining us each week. 40AM5 will be off next week and the week following, but we'll be back with you again in 3 weeks on Monday, May 5th. Until then, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.